Hi there, and welcome to Live from the Cyber Institute. In this podcast, we listen in on conversations taking place among ministers, church leaders, and scholars as we engage the issues facing Christians and church leaders today. We hope that this episode is thought-provoking and a blessing to you, because as with everything we do in the Cyber Institute, our mission is to equip church leaders and help churches thrive. After you listen, make sure to follow our podcast so that you get all the latest episodes from your podcast platform of choice. Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Live from the Cyber Institute, the podcast out of ACU Cyber Institute for Church Ministry. My name is David Knipe, and I'm the Associate Director here in Cyber, and I am very excited to be sitting down today with Amy McLaughlin Shesby, one of my colleagues in ACU's Department of Bible Missions and Ministry, and also the Director of Faculty Spiritual Formation in ACU's Adams Center. Amy, I'm so glad you're here. Welcome, and tell us some about yourself.
Well, thank you for having me, David. It's great to be here. I love what you're doing with this podcast. And it's always wonderful to have a conversation with one of my colleagues, mm-hmm. especially about things that we really care about relating to ministry and how we equip others for ministry. A little about myself here at ACU. I predominantly teach undergraduate students, though I have taught a little bit for the DMIN program. Mm-hmm. And the classes I teach range quite a bit.
Yep.
I get to teach some gen ed classes, so I get to know kind of the broader campus. And that includes like survey courses mm-hmm. over biblical literature. But I also get to teach preaching to our Bible majors. And I teach some wisdom literature online.
Nice.
And then I also am teaching this class that I created.
Okay.
My chair at the time last year said, hey, you know, I think we have a chance for you to teach a special topic course. I want you to think about it. You can pick whatever you want.
Nice.
And come back to me.
Okay.
And so I thought about it, and I had like a few ideas I was tossing around. But ultimately, I came back to him and I said, I want to teach a class about death.
Mm-hmm.
And he put his palm to his face, and he said, I told you you could pick anything, and you want to talk to undergraduate students about death.
Yeah.
I said, absolutely. And he said, we'll take a chance on this.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't make, or if there's not a whole lot of interest, then mm-hmm. we might, you know, opt out for a different direction.
Okay.
And so I started teaching this course called Mortality and Meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And the students call it Death Bible.
Okay.
and it's an upper-level theology course about mortality.
Yeah.
And everything that's kind of involved in that conversation. So we talk about the fact that humans die and how our mortality is kind of the backdrop against which we come to understand the meaning of life.
Mm-hmm.
But we also talk about like a theology of creation, theologies of suffering.
Yeah.
We talk practically about rituals and practices around death, especially mm-hmm. within the Christian faith. And I really love that class. I'm now teaching it for my third time.
That's so
great. Clearly there are enough weirdos on campus that want to have that conversation.
Yeah. Well, as someone who used to teach at ACU many years ago, I heard multiple times say to undergrads, it's good to think about your body rotting in the ground from time to time.
From time to time.
Right? Because what you said, that's going to change the way you think about life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's actually related to the things that we're going to talk about today. It's a topic
yes.
that I know is really close to a lot of the research and the writing that you're doing, but one that is also very much in kind of the public lexicon these days, mm-hmm. and that is trauma. It's something that is, of course, extremely relevant for ministers and for church leaders, as our audience will see. But because it's used so much these days, I'm wondering, could you give us kind of a working definition of this word? It gets thrown around a lot. Like, what are we talking about when we say trauma? Maybe in not so much a popular sense, but more official, more academic, or maybe what are we not talking about when we think
yeah.
of this term?
I'm so glad that you're seeking this clarification, because the word has definitely been kind of picked up as mm-hmm. In a really broad usage in
yes.
our society. I'm thinking about a student of mine who was running late to class, and she comes like kind of stumbling into class about 5 minutes after we started, and she's disheveled. And I said, are you okay? And she said, I'm traumatized.
Mm.
And I said, what happened? She said, Starbucks ran out of my favorite drink.
Yes. Yes.
And I understand she was using it to be comedic, right?
Uh-huh.
Hyperbole. but we have lost the kind of particularity of the term. Yep. I would say academically, trauma kind of has two primary trajectories right now. So there are ways of speaking about and writing about trauma that are more closely tied to its clinical sense. Mm-hmm. So how the term emerged in like psychological literature, mm-hmm. Among psychiatrists and psychologists and clinicians who work with people who are experiencing the symptoms involved with trauma, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Okay.
And then there's also kind of a theoretical trajectory that's been picked up by like literary theorists and historians and theologians lately, biblical scholars, mm-hmm. Who are recognizing that through our literature, our historical artifacts, artwork, film, you can find these traces of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Across these various media of our society. And so those are two very different trajectories, mm-hmm. and I've found myself kind of squarely in the middle here.
Okay.
with my own work, I'm drawing from kind of both sectors of literature. Trauma, if we were to define it, mm-hmm. You know, one way I like to describe it is suffering could be considered like the umbrella term.
Okay.
And under suffering, you might have different kinds of suffering that you could identify.
Right.
And one of those kinds of suffering would be trauma.
Okay.
Trauma can be distinguished from these other forms based on what happens in the emergence of trauma. So basically, when somebody experiences what we might call a traumatic event, mm-hmm. Those kind of like routine processes of the brain that observe what's happening in the event and start to integrate the event in real time in the brain's kind of standard features of like applying something to memory, mm-hmm. Narrativizing an event. Those processes freeze.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of break down. The limbic system of the body kicks into overdrive and kind of overrides some of those processes. and so basically the event is so forceful, it's so unexpected, so shattering. Mm-hmm. That's a word that comes up a lot in the mm-hmm. literature. It's kind of a shattering that the person emerges from that event without having integrated it in like kind of a standard way.
Yeah.
And so, and that can be true of like a singular event, or it could be like a series of events that are very traumatic. Mm-hmm. If somebody, for example, as a child had a traumatic upbringing, it might have been a series of events that were so overwhelming and unexpected. I really appreciate the way that one of my professors at Boston University describes it. Dr. Shelley Rambo says mm-hmm. that trauma can be observed in these three distortions, is what she calls them in her book, Spirit and Trauma. She says, first, there's the distortion of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have kind of a double structure to trauma, where there's the initial event that's kind of missed because the brain couldn't integrate it in mm-hmm. real time. So there's the missed event, and then there's a belated awakening of the mm-hmm. event. And so it has this kind of double structure.
So kind of like the things we hear about the athlete who gets hit on the football field and suffers a concussion, they will literally not remember mm-hmm. the thing that happened, and then later on, it may come along.
Yeah, kind of this awakening of the event.
Mm-hmm.
And the awakening can get triggered in unexpected ways, which we'll come back to in a minute. But there's this sense in which, like, past kind of perpetually inbreaks mm-hmm. into the present. There's a theologian named Serene Jones who wrote in her book, Trauma and Grace, about a woman who had this, like, kind of traumatic episode mm-hmm. in church. And how the traumatic memory kind of seized upon her body in a certain way during church. Mm-hmm. It was triggered by something that was happening in the liturgy. And it's like she was somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
right? We see this portrayed in TV and movies with like veterans who have PTSD.
Right,
where they might be sitting in their living room on the couch on the 4th of July,
mm-hmm.
and fireworks go off, and their body is suddenly catapulted back to combat.
Right.
when they're safe on the couch, yeah. right? Which takes me to the second distortion that Rambo identifies, and that is a distortion of body.
Okay.
The memory, because it's not embedded in kind of the standard processes, it gets embedded in the body, mm-hmm. in something like shards. It's like a fracturing of the memory in the body.
Like a shrapnel kind of situation.
Yes. Uh-huh. And so a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with this very popular book that came out by Bessel van der Kolk called The Body Keeps the Score.
It's a great book.
And I love the title of that book because that's exactly what trauma looks like. Like, that's how it happens, is it emerges in the body where the memory is left in fragments and it can be difficult to retrieve or articulate it. The body remembers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you're seeing in those depictions of trauma in film, is like a kind of awakening of the memory in the body. And so the body then is catapulted back to the event and responding as if there's a threat, when there may or may not actually be a threat.
Right.
And then the third distortion that she highlights is word.
Mm-hmm.
That oftentimes there's a struggle to bring the event to speech.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always the case, but it is often the case.
Okay.
Because when you are making memories of, like, just kind of normal events, let's say you got in a car accident, and maybe you didn't actually develop trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like a really bad, scary thing that happened.
Right.
And when you think back to the accident, you can actually tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, well, I was driving and I saw a deer run out in front of my car. I slammed on my brakes, but I started to spin out and wrecked into the margin.
Yeah.
And that's, you're able to tell the story because you were integrating it
mm-hmm.
in real time and applying kind of a narrative with language in your brain. If you emerged from that accident with trauma, you might struggle to piece together the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible that that language feature, the narrativizing that goes with standard memory making, just didn't get activated.
Yeah.
And so then somebody asks you about the accident and you kind of go blank.
Right.
And you can feel memories of it, but it's a difficult thing to try to bring it to speech.
I wonder if you mentioned, like, things that kind of TV and film stuff, you know, it reminds me of things like Law and Order episodes where we're watching not an interrogation, but an interview with a victim.
Yes.
And it's really difficult for the detectives because the victim is literally unable to put things into words.
Absolutely.
And I'm guessing that some of our folks, you know, in pastoral counseling kinds of sessions have had those kinds of conversations as well.
Yes. And what it means then is that if you're interacting with somebody who's been traumatized, a trauma survivor, it requires a different kind of listening.
Yeah.
And so a lot of trauma scholars write about the importance of listening and abiding with and being patient with, the importance of, like, bearing witness with the survivor, which just, it requires a different kind of competence, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to keep on talking about this, but I would love to hear, if you don't mind sharing, you know, what was it that got you interested in this? Tell us some of that story, as much as it is tellable.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a great question. I've asked myself that question many times. I think that probably the best answer I have is that I grew up in a ministry home. My dad's a minister, has been a minister my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the youngest of five, the only girl, and I got the ministry bug.
Yeah.
And my dad, much to his credit, saw that as a good thing and was happy to take me with him when he went about his ministry life, whenever it was okay and appropriate. And so oftentimes, if he was going to the hospital, he would bring me with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would drive out to the hospital to visit somebody who is ill or who's had an accident.
Right.
And he would kind of coach me in the car on the way to the hospital, things that he had learned from a long life in ministry.
Yeah.
And so he would say things to me like, okay, when we get into the room, here are some things you're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
Here are some things you might hear. Here are some things to expect. And then if I said something like, well, what should I say or what should I do? He'd always tell me, we're going to let them lead. We're going to let the person lead us.
Yeah.
If they need to yell, we'll make room for their yelling. If they want to be silent, then we will be silent with them. If they cry, we'll make sure we've got the Kleenexes. But otherwise, we're just going to let them lead.
Yeah.
And so those were really formative experiences for me that taught me from a young age how to be present in suffering and how to be present in grief. And so from a young age, I was kind of bearing witness to the ravages of life in my dad's church and our church.
Yeah, well, and you were watching someone that you looked up to do that as well, right? It wasn't just you doing that, but it was also half of your mind, I'm assuming, is kind of paying attention to your dad and what's going on there. And
so there's observing.
Lots of learning that's happening in an indirect kind of way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's probably why I ended up doing this. I was observing that this is actually really key to the things I write in my academic work, is I was observing that something happens to theology in those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
The kinds of things that we say about God, the kinds of things that we believe about God, the kinds of things that are appropriate to say about God, all of that changes in the presence of radical suffering. And I wanted to know what that meant. What does that mean? Is suffering like a detour to the theological imagination? Or is it in some sense setting the terms for our theological
imagination? Is it the home base of theological imagination?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so I appreciate you kind of situating that in terms of a life of ministry, because that's what a lot of our audience members are going to be, ministry leaders in different ways. Based on what we know, would you say that probably every church leader out there is connected in some way with some kind of trauma? If not in their own lives, then in the lives of their congregants.
Undoubtedly.
Okay. I mean, because like you said, this is a specific kind of suffering.
Yes.
But it's also very widespread.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's very prevalent. I mean, humans are, we're fragile and we're susceptible. We're vulnerable. And that means that trauma is around us all the time. And so, yes, ministers, if you are in ministry for more than 5 minutes, then you are absolutely connected in some way to forms of trauma in your church, trauma in your broader community, and likely, honestly, I mean, the minister is in a position of increased exposure to traumatic events. There are scholars who have observed that ministers have a same kind of exposure and susceptibility to trauma as like first responders do. Oftentimes, I tell my students that when disaster strikes your life, there's a very short list of people that get the first phone calls. And it's probably like 911, next of kin, and if you're a person of faith, probably your minister. And I knew that growing up, because if the phone rang at 2 a.m., my first thought was, somebody is having their very worst day. And so that means that the minister does have this kind of increased likelihood of direct exposure to trauma, and maybe even developing trauma themselves as a result.
So I'm assuming that probably some of our listeners can immediately think of some very obvious traumatic things, like you mentioned in the community. The when I was a freshman in high school, there was a group of kids that hit a tree on the way home from a party, and a really sort of popular involved kid died. It was a drunk driving situation, and it was one of those, you know, just affected the whole community.
Right.
So, you know, that picked up what you were saying before about the severity of the situation and its unexpectedness. But then there are others that probably folks are thinking of that maybe are more on that chronic side. You know, when it becomes clear that within a marriage in the church, there's been serial infidelity going on, or repeated child abuse. But could you give us maybe just some other examples? What are other examples of kinds of traumas that ministers might encounter that they might not even label as such? Just so we can kind of make sure we're kind of expanding our imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question, because, you know, trauma can be kind of surprising and unpredictable. An important distinction to make when talking about trauma is that there may be a traumatic event, and we might categorize it as such because of its unexpected nature, the force with which it emerges, and maybe one or multiple people emerge with clinical trauma.
Yeah.
But also, two people could experience the same thing that we call a traumatic event, and one person might leave with trauma and the other person might not.
Right.
And so trying to determine what kinds of things give rise to trauma, that can be really difficult. You already mentioned some important ones, I think. Things like abuse in the home, infidelity, accidents, certainly.
Yep.
I also think about, like, the way that addiction can impact a family. And often addiction is increasing kind of the vulnerability of the family to traumatic events. Other examples might include, like, natural disasters. When a community goes through, you know, like maybe a tornado demolishes a town, or a hurricane blasts through a region, and then you have a whole community that's literally left in the rubble.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense to me, because I think sometimes we think of traumatic events as they impact us bodily because our bodies are harmed. They impact us emotionally because a relationship is harmed. But in, you know, in this case, this is material disaster. A home is lost, but that means memories, of course. And then that also means what are the next steps and all those sorts of things.
Yes, and that unifying characteristic between all those examples is that overwhelming force. It's a moment where the person is acted upon by an unexpected force. They have no control in the moment.
That's right. Out of control.
Out of control. They can't anticipate it. And it has ramifications, right? And so there's that inability to integrate it in real time.
So something you were telling me about when we were discussing the idea for this podcast is that something we're getting a better sense of is the idea of secondary trauma that's really relevant for ministers. And I think if I remember right, you said that's kind of connected to that link with first responders. Am I remembering that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, absolutely.
Tell us about it.
So I'm grateful that a lot of scholars have started to pick up this concept of secondary trauma. Secondary trauma seems to emerge when somebody has a great deal of exposure to trauma. When you are witnessing it over and over and over again, maybe as part of your work or part of your vocation, sometimes symptoms that we associate with trauma, things like hypervigilance, or like irritability, or depression, anxiety, insomnia, these kinds of things, or even like a disruption of one's core beliefs. These are all symptoms that we associate with the phenomenon of trauma. And we've noticed that people who have frequent exposure to trauma often start to develop those symptoms.
Right. Even if they're in a caretaking mode. It's not that they're a member of the family who's connected to the other, they're actually the ones doing the caretaking, and they begin to show those symptoms themselves.
Absolutely. So I have met so many ministers whom, like, now in hindsight, having this language of secondary trauma, I wish I could go back and say, oh, this is what's happening, right? The minister who comes to me and looks like they haven't slept in 5 years, you know, and it's like, what's going on here? You know, or the minister who gets really like jaded and burnt out, and they don't even know if they believe the things that they're preaching anymore on Sunday, or like the person who suddenly develops really erratic behaviors. They're like drinking too much all of a sudden, and now with the theoretical lenses that I have, the knowledge that I have, I look at those and I go, I wonder if maybe there's some secondary trauma that's emerging.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So what I'm hearing is that dealing with traumatic events, the symptoms of trauma, this is extremely widespread, even though it might sometimes be hidden or invisible, right? Not obvious right off the bat. So if it's so widespread, I mean, I'm thinking, especially on behalf of our audience, are there things that we can do to prepare? Like, every situation people are going to run into needs its own individual response. But do you think that there are things we can do ahead of time or afterwards to kind of help us prepare for or cope with traumatizing events? Or maybe a different way to say it would be, are there some practices that we can involve in our lives that can sustain us in our ministry, knowing that we will face traumatic events, we will deal with people who are experiencing trauma. If we aren't now, it's just a matter of time.
Absolutely. I recently got to share this in a session at a conference mm-hmm. where I described doing ministry as kind of being in the belly of the beast. Mm. And I outlined for my audience sustaining ministry practices for doing ministry in the belly of the beast.
Yep.
And so I highlighted five that I'll share briefly. One, and first and foremost, is therapy or counseling.
Mm.
I know it still can feel a little taboo for some mm-hmm. people. And also, like, you know, a lot of us who go into ministry feel called to heal others.
Right.
To be a force of strength or stability, to be a source of wisdom. And so it can feel a little awkward to, like, swap the roles mm-hmm. and to be the wounded one. But that's why that metaphor of the wounded healer, I think, yep. is so potent, right?
You're saying that, I'm thinking of Henry Nouwen.
Right? I'm like, thank you, Nouwen.
Yep.
If we have to be able to identify first and foremost, like, we too are wounded mm-hmm. in some way. And especially if we're in ministry, we will be wounded along
yep.
the way.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's not always the case that you can, like, go home and talk to your spouse
right.
about ministry. Confidentiality is so important.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always the case that you can talk to fellow ministers, again, because of confidentiality.
Yep.
But you know who will always keep your secrets because they are legally obliged to do so?
Yeah.
Is a therapist.
Right.
It is so liberating. If you are in ministry of any sort, to be able to go to that room with a trusted professional and you can say whatever is weighing on you
mm-hmm.
and they will nod their head and listen very carefully. And then it's like a vault
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you leave therapy, that door gets locked and it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
That is such a gift and a blessing. And I know that therapy is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And not every minister is in a position where they can seek that out.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know that, like, medical benefits don't always include things for mental right. health care. And so I understand if it's difficult to find that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can, at least go digging around in your benefits. Sometimes these plans get hidden.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of benefits plans have something even like telehealth for mental health.
Yeah. Yeah.
I highly encourage that. The second recommendation is support systems.
Okay.
A lot of ministers I know do this well, mm-hmm. actually. They have friends in ministry that they text regularly or that they talk on the phone with. That's great. Whenever you start to feel like isolating because you're feeling wounded mm-hmm. or tired, that's when you need to challenge yourself to stay connected.
Mm-hmm.
Stay connected. I've always loved the advice of having an older mentor and a younger mentor.
Okay.
Another way to say that is, like, have an older friend and a younger friend.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who's further down the road from you that has some life wisdom and experience, and somebody younger than you that can learn from you. Maintaining those kinds of relationships
mm-hmm.
can be very healing and very stabilizing.
Yeah.
Third, Sabbath.
Mm.
Sabbath. Gosh, like, we weren't made for Sabbath. Sabbath was made for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gift. And I think that, you know, with ministry, there's no end in sight to the work.
Right.
It's never ending. It's not well contained. It just bleeds over into the next day and the next day and the next mm-hmm. day. And if you don't set boundaries for it, it will consume you over
yeah.
time. Even if you love every bit of the work you're doing, it will take every moment of your time.
Yeah.
And so by setting boundaries in your schedule and carving out time for Sabbath, whatever you can carve out,
mm-hmm.
I would even encourage you to talk with your elders about carving off an afternoon or a day of the week. Or maybe it needs to be something where, you know, once a month you take a 48-hour period,
mm-hmm.
Or once a quarter you take a long weekend or whatever it is.
Right.
Something to get grounded, because what we are declaring in faith with Sabbath is that we are not the ones who keep the world spinning.
Mm-hmm.
We are not the ones who make God's mission happen in the world.
Yeah.
We're reminded that actually, like, all the things that we think that we are successfully doing for the people of God, you know, throughout the week and week to week, well, actually, those are God's people.
Mm-hmm.
This is God's church. in God's world, and wonderful that we're here and that we get to participate in it, but it's not ours.
Right.
Right? And so we can take a step back and surrender that mm-hmm. to God. The fourth thing is heal your body.
Okay.
If the body is keeping the score in trauma, then that means that we need to be really attentive to our bodies.
Right.
You know, making sure we're sleeping, making sure we're eating and hydrating. And I get on my husband about hydration all the time, and he teases me about it. But seriously, like, if you are feeling out of whack, if you're getting headaches, if you're feeling emotional, I'm the first person that's going to ask you, have you had water today?
Mm-hmm.
Taking care of your body. I tell my students they're basically complex houseplants. They need sunlight, they need water, and sometimes they need to be left alone for a little bit.
Yeah.
Taking care of our bodies goes a long way towards our mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one, I'm kind of tickled by this one. You'll hear people say, oh, I just need to get centered. I need to center.
Mm-hmm.
My recommendation for ministers is get decentered.
Okay.
Decenter. Because ministers tend to feel like we're at the center of everything all the time.
Right.
And a lot of people will treat us like we're at the center of everything all
Correct.
The time.
Correct. Yep.
And so by decentering, it actually helps take that load off of your shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Ways that you can decenter. My favorite one is stargazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just like get away from the light pollution and go get quiet mm-hmm. while looking at the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And you will be reminded that you are not the center of everything.
Yeah.
Another one is like watching the ocean, right? If you mm-hmm. live near the coast, like, you can watch the waves roll in. And I mean, if you sit there quietly long enough, it doesn't actually take much time before you are overwhelmed by the magnitude
mm-hmm.
of creation and reminded that you are not the center of it.
Yeah. One that I do along those lines, I kind of go small rather than big. I like to go to a plant nursery
yeah.
and just walk around and look at the flowers. And we live in West Texas where we're recording. And so spring and fall are especially good here. Some people can do this year round. But for me, just the variety of colors, the variety of shapes, the variety of textures. And the kind of the great thing is at a nursery, they won't complain if you want to like feel the flowers, if you want to touch, if you want to smell.
Right.
And so I suspect that there's also sort of a multi-sensory thing that's happening. But that's one that I kind of found with a mentor of mine several years ago. And I don't get to do it as much as I ought to, but when I do, I'm never sad.
Yeah.
I'll usually put in headphones so that people don't try to talk to me, even if I'm not listening to anything.
Yeah.
But I see what you're saying. It helps just get a little bit of perspective, and I'm not, for me, with ministry in an academic context, I'm not grading any papers at that moment. I'm not talking to any students. I'm not in the middle of any meetings. I'm just there looking at the flowers.
Right. That's such a good practice. I think about how much I love to garden.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, on difficult anniversaries,
mm-hmm.
Anniversaries of tragedies mm-hmm. in my own life or people that I love, I try to carve out a little bit of time to go pot a plant
mm-hmm.
or like repot a plant, and just plunging my hands in the dirt
yep.
and reminding myself, from dust I came, to dust I return, I'm a part of this.
Yeah.
And then I often reflect on some of those teachings from Jesus on observing the world around you,
mm-hmm.
you know, consider the lilies of the field, consider the birds of the air.
Right.
And I find that really helpful too.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're coming toward a close. I've got a couple more questions I want to ask. So the first one is this. I'm guessing that it probably shouldn't be surprising to us that life is traumatic. I mean, we live in a world that kind of, we try to insulate ourselves from suffering, but it's, of course, all around us. And hopefully it's not surprising that, like, God can handle it. I think about Jürgen Moltmann's book, The Crucified God. And so I kind of want to talk theology for a second for our church leaders here. What are some resources that are in the Christian tradition already that you think can help us in this area of life and ministry? Is it points of doctrine? Is it events in church history? Is it something we do in worship? Like, we've got all these resources around us, so be the curator for us. Find some things that that can help us that we already have access to.
Absolutely. Well, I mentioned Shelley Rambo earlier,
mm-hmm.
A professor at Boston University. She was my second reader on my dissertation.
Okay.
And something that I learned from her that I've since come to share with my own students is she talks a lot about Holy Week, mm-hmm. which is timely. At the time of recording this, we are in Holy Week, and she talks about the importance of recognizing the potency of Holy Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of churches actually don't take much time to camp out on Holy Saturday.
Right.
We love Palm Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get enough of that. Got kids waving the palm branches.
Yep.
It's a big festivity. We love it. And we also are so good at Easter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, empty tomb all day. Like, we've got the Easter songs. Christ the Lord is risen today.
Yep.
We've got pastel colors everywhere. It's just like a big explosion of all things happy and bright.
Right.
But you don't have Easter without Good Friday and Holy mm-hmm. Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Easter isn't worth anything
mm-hmm.
without Good Friday and Holy Saturday. And Dr. Rambo, Shelley Rambo, taught me and my classmates that most of life is actually characterized by something like Holy Saturday.
Mm.
We spend our lives caught in a yet but not yet.
Yeah, in the in-between.
The in-between, the uh-huh. liminal space. As a Christian, I proclaim the hope of the resurrection, and I believe in it. But the reality is that most days I feel the wear and tear of my mortality.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that most days I am aware of grief and sadness and brokenness and loss. And so I hold on to the hope of my faith
mm-hmm.
and cling to it
mm-hmm.
as operative in this moment.
Yep.
But also, the hope of my faith is powerful because of my present circumstances,
mm-hmm.
which I can't deny or ignore.
Yeah.
And so, with my students, for example, we talk a lot about kind of the sadness, the darkness of Holy Saturday, what it means for God to become human,
mm-hmm.
And according to Philippians, right, like becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross,
mm-hmm.
And submitting God's self to the fullness of our human mortality.
Yeah. So this is, I know that you sometimes teach and do some work in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
I had not thought about this till hearing you say that. I wonder if, in terms of texts that we might deal with, like the exilic prophets might be a place. Because, I mean, there's a similar in-between. They've mm-hmm. been at home. They hear these promises that they're going back home, but it's not happening yet.
Yes.
And that's not a day. That's decades in between. Yes. And of course, the prophetic material is so powerful because yes. we're hearing God's voice in those moments.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. The prophetic works are really tremendous sources for our mm-hmm. theological imagination when mm-hmm. we think about what it is to be creatures who suffer.
Yeah.
My favorite book of the Bible, this is a shock to nobody who's known me for more than 2 seconds, is my favorite book of the Bible is the book of Job.
Okay.
And people always, you know, are kind of surprised to hear that. Either they think, really? Like, you like Job? Mm-hmm. The book about the worshipful, long-suffering sufferer? And I'm like, well, that's not really what it's about. Or sometimes people are like, you like the book of Job with that horrifically unsatisfying ending, and I'm like, okay, listen, there's 42 chapters to this book. It takes a long time to like kind of sit with it.
Uh-huh.
But something I love about the book of Job is it holds up what Carol Newsom describes as a contest of moral imaginations,
mm-hmm.
ways of conceiving of our lives in this world,
mm-hmm.
in a world that suffers.
Yeah.
And I find that really helpful. You know, these texts from Scripture that help us navigate the complexity of suffering and help us to ask better questions
yeah.
in the midst of our suffering. I really appreciate all of those works that can do that for us and with us.
That's great. Okay, here's where we're going to end. You talked about sharing this with ministers at a conference. Well, with a podcast, you have a chance to talk to church leaders all over, right? We get to see some of the places that our folks live. What is one either like takeaway idea or maybe an action item that you would want to share with church leaders, right? Like given all that we've said, we know trauma is going to happen. We know our people are suffering. We know we're going to feel the effects of this. So what is something that we should know or that we can do right now?
This isn't terribly practical.
Okay.
I think it concerns more of our postures in ministry.
Okay.
Wounds are always looking for a witness.
Hmm.
And wounds will assert themselves, show up in weird ways, interrupt,
mm-hmm.
Always looking for a witness.
Mm-hmm.
I've written before about how it's kind of like a haunting. Like, if you think about our ghost stories,
mm-hmm.
The typical arc of a ghost story is that there's an unsettled spirit
mm-hmm.
that's, like, looking for somebody to tell the truth about it, right? So that it can be set free or whatever. Similarly, go with me.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, wounds are kind of like this. Wounds haunt.
Mm-hmm.
And they move like specters at the edge of our worship services, in the cracks and fissures of our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hard to see sometimes.
Yeah.
But they're always looking for a witness. And I think one of the highest callings of a minister is to be devoted to becoming that witness,
mm-hmm.
to helping bear the truth of other people's lives, to helping people bring the truth of their lives into the presence of God. I think that that is one of the highest callings of the minister, and we can do that by being good listeners,
mm-hmm.
By being open, by anticipating there are things that we don't know about that would surprise us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trauma can be hard to believe. It can be hard to see, hard to hear. And a lot of times our first kind of gut reaction is to flinch away from it, or to think that can't be true or that can't be right.
Mm-hmm.
But a good witness will sit with the wound. A good witness will listen for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we as ministers have an ethical obligation to be attentive listeners. And I think we have a theological calling to bear witness to the truth of others' lives so that they can find themselves in the full presence of God,
yeah.
wounds and all, anticipating that future healing that we proclaim hope in.
You know, one of the things that both you and I have deep love for are Christian worship practices.
Yeah.
And just this week in my worship class, we were talking about prayer and looking at the things that we do in prayer and what that shows us about what we believe.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we talked about is that you don't have to say that God is a good listener
mm-hmm.
because our prayer practices assume it. Like, it's obvious that we believe that.
Yes.
Because otherwise, why would we spend time sharing these things? And so,
yeah.
I mean, it sounds like one thing you're saying is we get the opportunity to imitate the Lord.
Yes.
In listening with
yes.
our people.
Yes.
And that's a really powerful thing. And I suspect that's one of the things that a lot of people love about being able to do ministry is we get to be like Jesus in that
yeah.
way. And what you're describing is another way that we get to do that.
Absolutely.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for spending this time with me. It's so good always to get to visit with you and to get to talk to you about something that is A, so important, but B, is so close to your own heart and to your own area of interest and something that's just so relevant for us. I'm not going to be surprised if there are people in our audience that would like to reach out, would like to connect with you in some way to continue to talk about this. And if they want to do that, what's the best way? Should they send you an email? Are you on any particular social media platform? What would you recommend?
Absolutely. You can email me. My email is acm12a@acu.edu. Or you can find me on Facebook.
Okay.
I'm still pretty old school.
That's
my
right.
My college students think I'm a million years old because I'm only on Facebook, but that is where you can find me.
Okay. All right. Well, to our audience, let me just say thank you so much for being with us. And if this topic is of interest to you, and also just this kind of topic, let me recommend checking out our Mosaic blog. It's something that we host, but we have writers from all over that write for it, including a variety of topics around church life and discipleship and Christianity and culture. And there is already some stuff on trauma that's there. If you want to go to it, the website is mosaicsite.org. And if you add /follow after that, it'll take you to our subscription page. And of course, you can always access all of our podcast episodes at cybertinstitute.podbean.com. Thanks for being with us, and we'll look forward to our next episode.
Thanks for listening today to Live from the Cybert Institute. We would love to connect with you on our social media channels, and you can always find all of our various resources at our website, cybertinstitute.org. If you haven't done so yet, make sure to subscribe and follow this podcast on your platform of choice, then share it with your friends. Until next time, may God bless you in all that you do.